Georgia's once-a-decade redistricting process is ramping up, with leaders in the Georgia General Assembly hosting listening sessions around the state, including one Monday night in Brunswick. The League of Women Voters of Coastal Georgia's Rebecca Rolfus joins today's Commute Podcast to discuss the redistricting process and what Georgians need to know. Today is Tuesday, July the 27th, and you are listening to The Commute, presented by National Office Systems. My name is Adam Van Brimmer, and along with producer Zach Dennis, we bring you this podcast every Tuesday and Thursday. Today's episode focuses on a topic that doesn't get anywhere near enough attention, the redrawing of U.S. Congressional and State Senate and House district lines. And later in today's episode, Savannah Morning News City Hall reporter Katie Nussbaum will join me to discuss the long-anticipated closure of Savannah's city manager search and the hiring of Jay Melder. But first, a quick word about our presenting sponsor, National Office Systems. Here at the Savannah Morning News, we recently reopened our offices, and it's been great to see staffers in person regularly again. It helps that we have a great space designed and outfitted by Scott Center's team at National Office Systems. And we're not the only ones. National Office Systems has been working with Savannah area businesses for 30 years and leverages its partnerships with suppliers such as Dirt Modular Interiors and Herman Miller Office Furniture to deliver a top quality product. Learn more by visiting www.natoffsys.com. That's NATOFFSYS.com. Now, here's the League of Women Voters of Coastal Georgia's Rebecca Rolfus. Joined on this episode of The Commute by Rebecca Rolfus, who is with the League of Women Voters of Coastal Georgia, which is, I think it's safe to say, the most visible, probably the highest profile voting rights organization, advocacy organization in the Savannah area. And of course, Rebecca has joined me very often over the last couple of years between elections and other things, including the whole idea of redistricting. So Georgia, once every 10 years after the census, has a redistricting session where we redraw the lines for our, not only for our U.S. House districts, but for our state Senate and state House districts, and to kind of account for population changes. And the process is done in the Georgia General Assembly, and it is done by the lawmakers. So it is by nature a partisan endeavor. And right now the Republicans control both chambers. So we have to kind of keep that in mind as we start to think about that. Right now, that redistricting process is going to happen later this year. So currently the chairman of the two committees, one in the Senate and one in the House, that is looking at redistricting is holding these town halls, probably not the right way to put it, but they're hosting these listening sessions around the state. We had one for Coastal Georgia for the first congressional district Monday down in Brunswick. And the two chairpersons took some comments from Coastal Georgians about what they think about redistricting. And this is one of a series of these along the state, around the state, Rebecca. And I know that the League of Women Voters has been very outspoken about wanting to take a lot of the partisan politics out of this whole process, maybe even forming a nonpartisan commission. We know that's not going to happen, at least it's not this time around. But as these meetings have been going on in recent weeks, and as you look ahead to what they're going to do in the fall when they actually go about redrawing the lines, what do you think people need to know most in terms of the redistricting process in Georgia?
Well, right now, as you say, it's preliminary. The actual drawing of the lines, the meetings, the mapping, all of that kind of stuff will not happen until we get the data from the census, which will happen in mid-August, and then they will have meetings in September, and there will be a special session of the Georgia legislature to look at them and approve them. So the real nuts and bolts work will happen in a couple 3 months. What is happening now, these preliminary town halls, are really listening sessions. So it's the public's chance to say, this is what we want to see from the process and from the outcome. And so there are 11 of these town halls around the state, all over the place. Interestingly enough, they skipped Gwinnett County completely because it is the most diverse county in the state now, but you know, it's kind of obvious for its over being left out of the list. And so what happens is citizens go to an online portal. They say, I want to talk. I want to make a comment. They get 2-3 minutes. And it literally is that you make your comment, they go to the next person. There's no Q&A. There's no back and forth in terms of me saying, well, what are you going to do or how are you going to do it or anything like that? So it really is over and over the same message, regardless of gender, race, ethnicity, party, over and over the same message. We want this to be fair. We want it to be transparent. And the transparency is the part that is really missing, because when we get to the actual mapping, that tends to happen without public meetings and without live streams. All of these current town halls are available via live streaming. So the League and other voting advocacy organizations would like to see another set of meetings where we get to look at the maps. The maps are available online, and the public can ask questions and make comments. Because until you have something to kind of bounce off of and look at and say, this doesn't make any sense. Why did you draw this way? Why did you split this community in half, for instance? So adhering to the letter of the law in terms of keeping communities of interest together, which is part of the law on redistricting and reapportionment, they can give the appearance of doing that with actually not being very transparent about the process by which they arrived at those lines. And that is the thing we're advocating for this time around, because as you say, an independent commission is at least several years, if not a full decade in the future.
I hate to sound cynical in this whole thing, but these listening sessions sound a little bit like a dog and pony show. Do you get the sense that they're taking notes, and are we going to see anything? Are we going to see any kind of influence from these meetings reflected in what they do when they get the census data and start digging in here in another month or so?
I wish I weren't cynical either, but there is no anticipation that will happen, and there is no promise that will happen. You got to have your say. That may be the end of it. As I said, for one thing, the comments are a little repetitive.
This sure.
Over 100 people commented in the first 4 meetings, and then at least one was canceled because of the hurricane. So there's no feeling. All of this is being captured. All of this is being recorded. But what they will actually do with it, nobody has said, and there has never been any guarantee that it would change anything in this next process in September.
You mentioned earlier that Gwinnett County is not having a meeting. The other thing that's interesting from a geographic standpoint here is the fact that the first congressional district meeting is being held in Brunswick versus Savannah. Do we have any kind of information on why they picked one over the other?
No. I had the same question. Maybe Brunswick is a little more in the middle right. of the first district. I don't know. But yeah, there's no announcement really as to why they are where they are or not where they're not. But as I said, in Gwinnett County, which would be a county that has changed tremendously from a demographic standpoint in race, ethnicity, in age, and so forth, is really obvious for being omitted from the list.
Okay. Let's give people a little bit of context. We mentioned that they do these once every 10 years. And I think as we look at it now, we don't expect a whole lot of changes here locally, whether it's to what happens with the first congressional districts currently held by Buddy Carter, or what happens to our more local Georgia General Assembly districts. I think there's some thought that maybe Ron Stevens' district, which has become pretty much 50-50, might get tipped a little bit to be a little bit more Republican, but we're going to see. Stevens has got a track record. If anybody can win, can continue to win in a tight district, it's probably Ron Stevens. But all that said, if we look back 10 years ago to the redistricting, I think a lot of people maybe don't realize that from a U.S. House perspective, Savannah was home to 2 districts back then. You had John Farrow, who was in the 12th. I think that's why I said 12th earlier. And then I think at that time, Jack Kingston, who was in the 1st.
Right
now, the 12th got redrawn in 2000, 11, and is more Augusta-centric. And I think it touches parts of Effingham County, but for the most part, it doesn't have a whole lot of impact on our area. We're not going to see that kind of, we're probably not going to see those kind of changes out of this process. Is that fair to say?
I think that's probably fair to say, certainly from the federal district level, the first district, the one, as you say, that is currently Buddy Carter's territory. I don't think that is going to change much. Some of the local ones, the local Georgia legislative lines may move a little bit. In terms of coastal Georgia, one of the determining factors and one of the things that kind of protects us is we have a lot of water, and the district lines kind of follow the water. They follow the inlets, they follow the islands. The things that make no sense, this is just one for instance, the campus of Savannah State is cut in half.
For the state house.
Why? I mean, they may have good reasons for having done it, but it doesn't make any sense. And that's the kind of question that we never get an answer to. If you look at it, it kind of looks like the residential part of the campus is in one district. The place where people vote is over, where the voters are, is over here, and the administrative buildings are in a different district. Okay, again, maybe that makes sense, but it is a community of interest, an obvious community of interest. Why is it split in half? What results over time from this sort of process is you make election campaign individual races less and less competitive. Mm-hmm. So in 2020, over half of our big elections had no opponents. And three quarters of the state elections had no opponents because nobody's going to run in a district that they know they can't win in. Elena Parent, who is a member of the Georgia legislature and has been extremely vocal on redistricting, was in the Georgia Senate, and she was gerrymandered out of her district. So she ran for the House. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can literally cut the line so fine with having elected officials draw the lines, is the temptation is huge to draw the lines to favor your own party.
Protect yourself.
It's self-interest. So I can say who gets to hold this office, or at least which party gets to hold this office. And eventually you have the same people over and over and over. When you look at not only who is running, but how many people vote. So in the last election, for instance, X 100,000 people voted in the governor's race, and then that dropped. I mean, it tanked. And you got to some local races because the same guy was running who's been in there forever. I'm not interested. I don't vote for him. I mean, maybe I didn't want him in the first place, but I know he's going to win. He doesn't have an opponent. So people just don't vote. Mm-hmm. So it's not only are you gaming the system, but you are kind of disenfranchising people because you don't give them any on who to vote for.
Right. So as we look ahead to what's ahead in this process, I know the League of Women Voters of Coastal Georgia has an event planned, I think, in September. I got a note the other day. I'm moderating it. So we'll look forward to that. And also the League of Women Voters of Georgia, so the parent organization of the statewide organization, the president of that, Susanna Scott, has a op-ed that ran online in Wednesday's Savannah Now and is in print in Thursday's Savannah Morning News. This will be last week. So what do we need to know in terms of League of Women Voters advocacy, events, other things? What should we follow? Where should we go if we're interested in keeping up with this process as over the next couple of months?
Well, we're posting everything in terms of events, whether it's our event, a state event, or one of our partner organizations with whom we work quite closely is Fair Districts Georgia, who does nothing but this. This is their main focus. And all of us are advocating for another set of public meetings.
Yes.
So after the district lines are drawn, there need to be another set of public meetings that are live streamed, that are recorded, that the maps need to be posted and so forth, as I said, for public comment. That is our main focus. So you can go to our Facebook page, certainly our website, which is lwvcga.org. We'll do our best to keep on top of it so that people can follow us and thereby know what's going on.
Well, that's good stuff. It's something that I think it's not top of mind right now, but it needs to be, because once we get into the fall and everything else, it's going to be hot and heavy. I guess the saving grace is that this year in November, our elections are purely municipal, and there's not a whole lot of municipalities that have a whole lot of stuff on the ballot. So a lot of the public focus can be on what is going on at the Georgia Capitol with redistricting. And I just hope that people kind of get a sense of how important and how impactful this can be. Even if we can't impact it this time, that groups such as the League of Women Voters can push for change in the future, because this is something that, unfortunately, we've seen, in my opinion, we've seen partisan polarization increase significantly.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
In the last decade, and what's going to happen over the next decade.
The last time they did this was the first time since passage of the Voting Rights Act that the lines in Georgia had not been subject to the Department of Justice review. They drew them in such a way that the Department of Justice said, okay, this is fair. Making that even better, and then, as I said, allowing public comment in the process would go a whole long way to making our organization and voters in general trust that their elections are going to be run in a way that is fair to both sides, regardless of the party.
Well, that's a goal all of us should have. From your lips to
what gets me out of bed every day, Adam.
Yeah, from your lips to hopefully everybody else's ears, but we'll hold our breath on that one. But Rebecca, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks for what you and the league do. Of course, Rebecca's a past president. Nina Altshuler is the current president, and we'll look forward to talking to her down the road. Thanks again, and it's always good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you too, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Thanks one more time to Rebecca Rolfes. Before I bring on my colleague Katie Nussbaum to talk Savannah's new city manager, I want to give a plug to the best source for local news in Savannah. Yeah, that's right. It's us, Savannah Morning News and SavannahNow.com. We go in-depth on topics important to you, whether it's Savannah's city manager search, well, there you go, you're about to hear about it, or the best new restaurants around town. If you aren't a subscriber, now's the time to try us out. You can get full access to our digital content for $1 a month for the next 6 months. Although Stories Mart's subscriber only on our website, this gets you behind the paywall. So dig under those couch cushions and check the pockets of those pants you put in the laundry for some coins or some small bills and subscribe today. Go to savannahnow.com/subscribe now and sign up. Here's Katie Nussbaum. Going to spend the balance of today's commute talking with journalist Katie Nussbaum, who covers City Hall for us here at Savannah Morning News and has been incredibly busy with an incredible slate of news, not unexpected news, whether it was the naming of a city manager, which I think a lot of us knew or hoped that it was going to come down the pike, but then, of course, also yesterday, the re-implementation of the mask mandate, which, given the trends in terms of COVID numbers in recent weeks, I think a lot of us wondered if this wasn't going to happen. And of course, it did happen yesterday on Monday, July the 26th. But Katie, let's go ahead and start with that. And I know that, as I said, it wasn't a surprise. I know you got to the press conference and saw a lot of medical professionals and other representatives of the different hospitals and the county health department there. And that was kind of a tip off that it was coming. But what kind of struck you about the mayor's presentation or reasoning behind re-implementing the mask mandate?
Yeah, well, I think the reasoning obviously is the surge of COVID in recent weeks, especially with the new variant. Hospitalizations have gone up. You know, the vaccine rate is not where he would like it to be. And of course, he has talked about, you know, bringing this back several times. So like you said, it wasn't very much of a surprise yesterday. He didn't use a lot of specific language as far as the actual order that he was you know, enacting. Of course, we got a copy of that later. And, you know, commercial businesses, it's still just strongly advised, whereas kind of in the press conference, it was he said, you know, if you're indoors, you need to wear a mask.
Right.
So it was a little bit, you know, varied there in the language. So,
yeah, it seems like much like the last time, more psychological than anything, right? Is, yeah. You know, if the city is saying that you need to have it, then hopefully all the businesses will get on board. And if the businesses are on board, then they can get some customers on board. Because really, over the last couple of months, I don't know about you, but when I'm out, nobody's wearing a mask anymore.
Right.
Yeah. And maybe if they're thinking if they can get 20% increase or more, that maybe that'll slow it down enough to keep it going. And he talked about trying to get a 10% increase in terms of vaccination rates. So to me, it was pretty obvious that what he was really doing was trying to suggest to people that if you're a holdout, get the vaccine. That way we don't have to have these kind of mandates. Yeah. Did you kind of get the same impression?
Yeah, absolutely. He spent really the majority of the press conference before he actually announced that the mandate was coming back, talking about the numbers, the surges, you know, what's going on, and talking about the vaccine and the rate. And of course, you know, had the medical professionals coming up and kind of pleading with people and saying, here's a clinic we're having, it's free, you don't need an appointment, you know, come get vaccinated. So there was a huge push for that yesterday.
And he also revealed how many tickets they wrote during the first, I guess the first one was in place for, was it almost a year?
Yeah, it was July of last year, yeah. I think, when it was first out.
All right. So how many tickets was it?
Six.
So
not very many.
Yeah. But and I know at one point they had city marshals, the city staff that were, for lack of a better word, deputized to write these citations. But yeah. I think a lot of what the governor said undercut that a little bit. And of course, Governor Kemp has said the same thing now, that he's not interested in having a mask mandate. Did any of the state considerations come up in the discussion yesterday, or did the mayor kind of avoid that?
They didn't, no. But I think it was just Friday, like you said, Kemp said, you know, he's not interested in bringing back any restrictions, but he was encouraging people to go get vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to his office yesterday about this, and they said the current orders don't, you know, have anything to do with mask mandates as they are now. So, but they just encourage people to get vaccinated.
It'll be interesting to see if anybody follows suit. Our colleagues at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution took the news from Savannah yesterday and talked to the mayor of Atlanta, the mayor of Athens-Clark County, the mayor of Sandy Springs, which is part of the Atlanta metro area. And everybody seemed to kind of hedge their bets on this. So Mayor Johnson is out there on his own, which he's not uncomfortable being that way,
right?
But it's pretty interesting. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, in relation to the order yesterday, where you need to wear a mask, according to the order, they're still trying to enforce it on like tours, such as trolley tours, if you're on a pedicab, that type of thing. And the order did state that you could be, you know, subjected to a $50 fine under city code. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because to me, those are still private businesses.
Right.
But we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's certainly, if you've been downtown, whether they're wearing a mask or not, social distancing does not exist.
Right.
So it will, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the tourists react. But then again, we are in almost August, so maybe the tourism is going to drop off. I kind of doubt that too, because a lot of pent-up demand, and we continue to see it really busy downtown. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about city manager. I know that it went very, very late last Thursday night, and you watched the entire four-hour meeting. Mm-hmm. I caught the end of it. What had you heard had happened earlier in the day, and did it match your expectations of when it actually came down the pike?
Yeah. You know, for weeks, Mayor Johnson has talked about wanting to get that unanimous vote, that 9-0 vote for whoever they chose. And, you know, this council is typically a divided one. Yeah, so I think everybody was wondering if that was going to happen. They had an executive session after the workshop on Thursday, and Bannett said, if we can kind of get to that consensus, then we'll put it on the agenda. And so even when I saw it on the agenda, I was still wary. Did we get to a consensus, or are we just going to vote on it and see what happens? So it was very surprising. And it was a good way to end a 4-hour meeting. So,
and then of course I throw us a curveball, right? Because the first thing they go, we're going to talk about this last item on the agenda. And it's about making Heath Lloyd the interim city manager. And when I heard that, I was like, does that mean that they did not come to consensus and they're going to start this thing over a third time?
Right.
Or what's going on? And I imagine you were probably in the same
boat. That threw me off. I had a kind of a story written for each candidate so that we could, you know, get it up there after the news was announced. And so my brain was in multiple places. And when that was announced, like, I just kind of panicked and I'm like, I got to switch stuff out and we got to get it going. And we had a conversation after that, and you were like kind of explaining, nope, this is what happened. So I went back and listened to it and got myself under control. But that was curveball. So.
Yeah. For people that haven't followed it closely, what happened was they talked about Heath Lloyd being the interim first because current acting city manager Michael Brown basically decided he's not going to stick around until Jay Melder comes on in September. But the thing was when it was broached that Brown was stepping down and Lloyd was stepping in, they had not said anything about Melder. So your initial thought was, okay, what the heck has happened? What is going on with Melder? They get through the whole thing about Heath Lloyd. They vote on that. They approve that. Then Mayor Johnson says, and we are here to talk about appointing Jay Melder, because they still have to do some background check and dot some I's and cross some T's before they officially hire him, which I believe is going to happen at the next meeting, assuming they have all this done. And then they talked about Jay Melder. You, of course, spent the next day burning up the phone lines, talking to all the council members. Like you said, it was 9-0 unanimous, which I think was, to me, the most surprising, even more surprising than the pick, was the vote. When you started to talk to these council members, and it's a divided council, were you struck at how united they were? Not only how united they were, but the reasons behind why they were for Melder.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, the 9-0 vote was kind of a shock or a surprise to me as well. And I talked the next day to Mayor Johnson. I talked to Curtis Purty, Keisha Gibson Carter, and they all pretty much said the same thing about Melder in their own ways. But, you know, they loved his experience working through homelessness and COVID and, you know, everything that he brought to the table. And they thought he was very personable and approachable and a good listener. So, you know, they all were right there behind him, it sounded like. So I think that, you know, hopefully is a very good sign of things to come.
Right. I know he's got a lot going on, but, and I know you've at least seen some statements from him, maybe even had some short conversations with him. What is your impression of him? What are you expecting out of him as a leader? Or is it too early to tell?
I'm not sure. The city released a brief statement by him Thursday night. I haven't actually been able to have a conversation with him yet, which I'm looking forward to doing that. But he seems very eager to take the job. I feel like it seems like he's into it 100%, which is another thing that I heard from council members that stood out about him during the media interviews and the panel interviews with the community that he did in June. So.
Right. Having him in place, of course, removes what has been a pretty big obstacle to this council getting anything done. So he comes into place. We have a large percentage, significant percentage of the task forces have delivered their reports. Is it time to get this done or move on to other issues? Are we getting to a point where this council's really got to take some action, you think, on some of these priorities?
I certainly hope so. And that's one thing that you know, Mayor Johnson brought up is when you have an interim city manager, they might be kind of hesitant to carry out some of those strategic plans and those long-term views because they know somebody else is going to be coming in behind them. So hopefully, you know, this permanent city manager, which will be the first permanent since 2019, they can get some of the things that they want to do and get them done.
Yeah, well, I think that the onus is ready to fall back on city council. So I'm sure you will have quite an enjoyable time covering them as they chronicling their discussions and approach to getting these things done. But Katie, thanks so much for the work that you do. And thanks for taking the time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's a wrap on this episode of The Commute. Thanks one more time to our presenting sponsor, National Office Systems. Please support them as they support this podcast. If you enjoyed this episode of The Commute and want to hear more, download archived episodes on your podcast app by searching The Commute with At Savannah Opinion. We had two great episodes last week featuring Savannah Olympian Michael Cohen, as well as one with the general manager of the M Market Arena, Monty Jones. Be sure to thumb those episodes up if you haven't already. The Commute returns with a new episode on Thursday. We'll talk to you then.